Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the GNSA Working Group Newcomer Open House session on the 5th of June 2014. On the call today, we have Bartlett Morgan and Dan Rogers. We also have our presenter, Thomas Vickett, and from staff, we have Marika Koenigs and myself, Matthew Peregrin. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you, Marika.
Thanks, Natalie. So hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us to our monthly open house session. As well, we'll go through the slides and the meeting agenda. You'll see this is really intended to be an open discussion, allowing everyone to ask any questions they may have in relation to participation in GNSO working groups. So as we start this meeting, I thought it would maybe first be good to have a little introduction on who we are on the policy staff side, and probably hand it over to Thomas to say a little bit about himself, and then I think then Natalie will provide a little introduction into Adobe Connect and how we typically use that for our meetings as well as this session before we dive into to some of the more meaty subjects of the presentation that we have available. But as I said, in the meantime, if there are any specific topics you'd like to hear about or are curious about, feel free to already note that in the chat, and I will make sure to focus on those. So very briefly, it's not just me and Natalie that provide support to the GNSO. There are a number of colleagues that provide support from different locations in the world. Our fearless leader, David Olive, is based in Istanbul, Turkey. He's Vice President for Policy Development. As within our team, we also support other supporting organizations and advisory committees within ICANN. I myself am based in the ICANN office of Brussels. Glenda Saint-Jury, who is a GNSO secretariat, she's based in the south of France. Mary Wong is based in New Hampshire, US. Judy Hedlund, who also supports the ASAC, is based in Washington. Lars Hoffman is also based here in the office in Brussels. Barry Kopp, who is a consultant to the policy team, is based also in the US. And Natalie, who is also on the call with us today, is also based in the sunny south of France. So maybe, Thomas, I'll first hand back to you so you can have a chance to introduce yourself as well. And thanks again for joining us and co-hosting this webinar. And then maybe we can first have Natalie explain a little bit about Adobe Connect and how to use that before we dive into the rest of the presentation.
Sure. Thanks, Marika. My name is Thomas Rickert. I'm a lawyer by profession, and I'm based in Germany. I've been working in the domain industry for like 15 years, and I've been following ICANN since its very beginning. Since 2011, I think it is, I am on the GNSO Council as a NOMCOM appointee, so the nominating committee has picked me, and since then I'm on the GNSO Council currently in my second term, so I will be remaining on council for another 1.5 years, roughly. I should also say that next to being a lawyer, I'm also working with an Internet Industry Association in Germany, which has more than 700 members from more than 60 countries, so it's quite international. And I'm chairing, content-wise, the area inside this association that deals with domain and DNS-related questions. So I'm regularly setting up events to inform the community, not only companies, but also the wider user group to topics that are relevant to the domain industry, such as the new DTLD program and other stuff. And ICO, and I will finish this advertising slot momentarily, is also quite engaged in the internet governance arena, and it will shortly be hosting the EuroDIC, the European Dialogue on Internet Governance, in Berlin. So that's it for me, and I have been asked whether I had any wishes for this meeting, and I've heard a couple of the former meetings of this format, and I found it very valuable for Natalie to actually guide the participants through the Adobe Connect, which is the technical tool that's primarily used by ICANN for remote meetings. And without further ado, I'd like to hand over to you, Natalie.
Thank you very much, Thomas. Well, welcome everyone. First, you've all made it into the Adobe Connect room, so that's an excellent first step. Well done. I would just like to inform you, however, that you may have noticed that you don't have any other choice than to log in as guest in the Adobe Connect room. Now, this is nothing you're missing out on. It's perfectly normal. All members of the community always have to log in as guests. The host logins are for staff only. However, if one day you do wish to present something or to host a meeting, as you can see on here, we have Thomas Rickett, our current presenter, on the presenter side, on the attendee list. So staff can always promote you to a presenter or host if you have that need. Next thing you might see next to your names on the attendee list, that there are microphones there. This means that the microphones in the Adobe Connect room have been activated. This means that you do not need to dial in to listen or to participate into the meeting on the phone. What you can do is simply use the voice over IP of your laptop and computer. To do this, it's extremely simple. You click on the telephone icon at the top toolbar of the Adobe Connect room and follow the instructions. You'll know this has been successful when the telephone icon turns into a microphone icon. And then to mute and unmute your microphone, you would simply click on the white arrow on the right-hand side of that microphone icon. I know sometimes a few people have hits and misses at the beginning of conference calls. If you do realize that you're having technical issues with this, please don't hesitate to drop me a quick email. We can always do a few trial runs before the next conference call. You can see that Dan and I have written in the chat pod at the bottom. Please be aware that much as these conference calls are recorded, we also keep the content of the chat pod. They're served as archives, as often they are parallel conversations going on the side, as well as the main conference call conversation. You can, however, initiate private chats, be it with another participant of the conference call, a member of staff, or the chair, for instance. To do this, you would highlight the name of one of the participants or hosts or presenters in the attendee list, and you will have the option to start a private chat. This will therefore create another tab at the bottom of the chat pod, as well as the Everyone tab you can see now. The content of these chat pods, however, those do remain private. They're at no moment are they made public. One of the traditions in an ICANN conference call is the raise hand option. The raise hand option is essential when taking part in a conference call to be able to voice your opinion. You simply can't unmute your microphone or your telephone and interrupt the chair, for instance. Yeah, protocol demands that you raise your hands to do so. The raise your hand option is pretty much where you found the telephone icon on the top toolbar. It's the hand raised person, the last icon on the right-hand side. If you click on that, you can raise your hand. This does not give you automatic right to speak. It simply signals to the chair that you have a comment or maybe a question to ask. Once your question is asked, please remember to go back to that same icon and to put your hand down. Otherwise, it still gives the impression that you're asking further questions. In the same little icon, you can also express your agreement or disagreement with the green tick or the red cross. This can be very handy, for instance, if the chair is taking a quick survey regarding, for example, your availability next week for another conference call. You can quickly next to your name mark a cross or a tick saying whether you'll be available or not. Equally, without being prompted by a question, you can always use these to express your agreement or disagreement with whatever comment is being made. And that, I think, is all for the basics of the Adobe Connect. I guess a few of you knew all about this, others maybe not. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to ask them on the chat or by email, as I said before. And I'll hand it back to you, Thomas. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Natalie. That's been very helpful. And let's now dive into the substance of this session, unless you have any questions. So I pause for a second to see whether you have any questions before we move on. Hearing and seeing on the chat, I think we're good to go. As Marika mentioned earlier, the agenda for this meeting is flexible. Also, we're quite small groups, so please do make yourself heard or do write a comment in the chat so that we can interrupt the presentation and have a discussion. The goal, as you can read on the slide in front of you, is that we share informally a little bit of experiences. So if you have experiences, good ones, bad ones, connected to our topic, please make yourself heard. I think that might be interesting for everybody to learn. Again, ask questions, and we will try, or I will try my best to provide you with some more background information, also some tips which to navigate through this GNSO working group process. Now, we are going to listen to your questions, certainly, but in order to answer them, you would need to ask them in the first place, which, again, I encourage you to do. And then we have some standard questions that newcomers would usually ask, and which we've provided some answers on the subsequent slides. So you'll be learning shortly about the GNSO policy development process, or the acronym for that would be PDP. That's something that you're going to be hearing during this call quite some time. We're going to talk about consensus policies and the associated term of the picket. For a long time, the picket fence has been a mystery to me. I'm sure that I'm not the only one in the community who's been struggling with that concept, but I hope that I'll be able to shed some light on that. We're going to talk about the working group guidelines, the guidelines that working groups try to adhere to. I mean, it's good to have volunteers working on something, but it's even better if they know in what format that they can work, and to have something that guides them to go through the sometimes cumbersome process. We're going to talk about the mechanics. We've already touched upon the Adobe Connect. We will be alluding to the wikis as we move on, and hopefully we'll be able to give you some tips and tricks. Before I move on to the PDP process, as you will surely have heard the way I speak, and as I mentioned in my introduction earlier, I'm not a native speaker, and I'm sure that some of you are not either. So please let me know if I say something that you don't understand, or if you want me to move slower. I'm trying to be slow enough for everybody to understand, but certainly I can't say exactly whether you can follow me. So please don't hesitate to let me know if you want me to slow down, and I will do my best to do so. Now, this graphic that you see in front of you is a simplified version of the course of the policy development process for the generic name supporting organization. As you will know, there are other groups inside ICANN or outside ICANN which also have policies that they develop and that they're working on. So this one might be similar to other policy development processes, but this is the one that is tailor-made for the needs of the GNSO. And you should also know, and I should take this as a free preface, I mentioned that I'm on the GNSO Council, and sometimes people think that the GNSO Council would be the, let's say, leadership team that ultimately defines policy, and that is a very serious misconception of how the generic name supporting organization works. Our policy is done by the GNSO community. The GNSO Council, as a group, is the steward of this policy development process. So the council needs to make sure that due process is followed. They can ask questions if they think that working groups are not doing their work properly, but they do not substitute or alter policy that is being made by the community. And therefore, I think this is maybe the most important takeaway message from this. The work that you're interested in doing or doing already in working groups, that's the vital part of what makes the hardcore of ICANN. ICANN's reason to be is primarily, at least that's my view, I'm sure that others will object to this, but it is my firm belief that the policy development i.e. setting the framework for generic names is the main substance of what ICANN does. And the working groups that are developing policy for that are the integral part of that. So we have to make sure that this part of ICANN is strong and gets more and more volunteers that are interested in participating in this process. But at the same time, we have to ensure that those that are donating their private time to engage in policy development are actually appreciated by the council effectively working with the results, but also by the board and the wider community acting swiftly so that you can see rather sooner than later that the results of your work are actually operationalized. So if we look at this graph now, that's sometimes called the snake. As I mentioned, that's a simplified version of what a PDP entails. Everything is spelled out in the policy documents that we're going to refer to later on, and you can certainly read those, but I think that as a starting point, this snake covers the most important parts. So if you look at the upper left section of this graphic, you see the request for an issues report. So before we start a PDP, actually we need to find out whether there is an issue. So usually we do not do PDPs out of the blue, but there is an issue in front of the community that needs to be resolved, and also that needs to be resolved in a fashion that it would become a binding solution for everybody in the community to adhere to. And therefore, we need to see whether the task that we're working on is actually in the scope of the GNSO. So we can't suddenly try to impose policy for, let's say, sports or some other areas of life. So is this inside the scope of the GNSO? Then we take a look at whether there is research already being done. You know, do we have empirical data on the issue at hand? Do we know whether people have been working on this issue before? So is there any documented position on that, or maybe multiple documented positions on the issue? And further, are there other considerations that we need to put into the equation before we start the work? And that issue report is then published, and you will see that gathering public comments is something that you find quite often in this graph. And that's for good reason, because it shall not only be parts of the community. I mean, certainly the working group members will have an awful lot to do during this process, but it is very important that the wider community is embraced at multiple stages of this process to ensure that the working group, which certainly has a lot of expertise on board, but to ensure that the working group, which might not have all expertise or all knowledge at its fingertips, actually doesn't forget anything to look at. So the preliminary issue report is then public. Then it's posted for public comment. Usually those public comment periods are 21 plus 21 days. That's the public comment plus the reply period. So even if you have lost the chance to comment during this first period, you can still comment during the second period. And the public comments will be analyzed, and they are really being analyzed. I can assure you there were times when ICANN has been accused of not really taking into account public comment, but that it's rather a black hole that you throw your comment in and it will never resurface to sunlight. But having worked in this process for quite a bit, I actually can confirm that each and every public comment is being reviewed. It is analyzed for whether there is something in there that is not yet in the document that is being commented on, whether anything has been forgotten, whether it's on topic or not, and then it's actually being summarized So everything is being encapsulated then in a review report of the public comments. And after tweaks to the preliminary issue report have been made, based on the public comment that has been received, it's published for the final report is published. And subsequently, the policy development process is initiated. The section starting at the lower right side, at the top end, though, is that a working group is being formed. So a request to all stakeholder groups, which we call SGs, constituencies, is sent out to solicit volunteers to participate in the working group. And I see a hand up. So, Carlos, please move on.
Yes, Thomas, thank you. Sorry for being so not so sure. You who produces the initial the issue report? Because you just said the working group is formed after it has taken a decision about the policy development. Is this a pre working group? Is this less official or the same working group?
Yes, so thank you very much for the question, which is a very good and relevant one. The phase of creating an issue report is the phase where we try to find out whether there is smoke or there is fire. And this report is usually produced by ICANN staff. Actually, I'm not aware of any instance where community members have produced an issue report, but Marika might wish to chime in and correct me if I'm wrong. So that part is usually done by ICANN staff, but certainly community input is solicited, as you can see in the middle section of the upper side of the graph, by incorporating public comment. But these issue reports are triggered by sometimes the council, and sometimes by the ICANN board. It can be asked for by individual councillors and also by other supporting organizations. But Marika has raised her hand, so please, Marika.
Yes, thanks, Thomas. And just to add, yeah, you're indeed completely correct. The development of the issue report is a staff responsibility, but as Thomas noted, the idea that the request for an issue report is pretty detailed, already provides what is the issue supposed to look at, what are you trying to address, which problem are you trying to solve, what is the information that the requester may already have about the issue. So the whole idea of the issue report is that staff basically goes out and gathers as much information as possible around the issue. Like Thomas said, to be able for the council to assess, is there just smoke or is there really fire? So we don't make any recommendations on how the issue may be addressed or voice an opinion on whether it's a good or a bad issue. And what we usually do is indeed scope the issue, provide as much information as possible as we can find, either from data, from studies, or maybe from positions that groups have expressed. There's also a section in the report that deals with the scope question. Is this really within scope for the GNSO Council to consider? And it looks at certain questions in that regard. And then we typically also provide a recommendation on whether we believe a PDP should be initiated or not. And that typically looks at issues that should first additional research be undertaken, or should the PDP, should the council decide to initiate a PDP, what kind of questions may the PDP need to address in order come to get to recommendations at the end. So it really deals with the kind of scoping and if a PDP is initiated, how that may best be organized in order to address all the issues that have been encountered as part of the issue report. I'm getting a bit of echo.
May I jump immediately? And it is addressed to the council.
Yes, so this is Marika. So the preliminary issue report is actually published for public comment. So that goes out to the whole community. And the whole idea is to ask the community, did we miss anything? Is there any information that we actually haven't included in the report that should be there in order for the council and the subsequent working group to have the information they need to actually start looking into potential recommendations or solutions for the issue that has been identified? So once those public comments have been processed, and they may also, you know, provide guidance to the GNSO Council on whether or not parties believe that a PDP should be initiated or not, we update the report to reflect, you know, any changes that we believe are within the scope of the issue report, and then submit that final issue report together with the report of public comments to the GNSO Council so they can make a decision on whether or not to move ahead, you know, with the next step, which would be the formal initiation and then forming of a working group.
So, Carlos, I hope that answers the question. Otherwise, please do jump in and ask a follow-up question. Thank you, Marika, for this additional information. And I'm very thankful for the question because it allows us to respond and make the section a little bit more vivid and interactive for all of us. I would like to add that both the preliminary issue report as well as the final issue report are brought before the GNSO Council, and they are being discussed there. So the Council, in its mandate to manage the policy development process, looks at that and also gives some input and has additional questions sometimes of what should go into this report. And the voting threshold, if the initiative for an issue report comes from a GNSO councillor, it's being voted on by the GNSO council, but the threshold is very low. And I think that that's also an important signal, basically to say that we don't need much to take a look at an issue, whether it's present or not, and do some desk research and see whether we have to do some further work on that. And then the threshold for adopting the final issue report and kicking off the formal PDP is then a little bit higher. Carlos, I'm not sure, as well as Marika, whether the hands that are raised are old hands or new hands. So if there are new hands, please speak up. And if it's an old hand, you might...
Sorry.
Not to worry, dog. So the working group is now being formed, and hopefully there's broad representation from the various groups in the GNSO, but also we encourage more participants to join. And then every group in this ecosystem is formally asked for input to ensure that, number one, everybody in the community or every group has this new project on its radar, to solicit volunteers to participate as working group members, but also to get some guidance and some initial reaction and suggestions on how to tackle the issue that is attempted to be resolved in with the working group. And after the working group has deliberated, and usually the deliberations take place on a weekly basis, and the meetings usually take an hour. I've seen PDPs where there have been weekly meetings that take 2 hours, but I think that the general rule of thumb is that you should factor in an hour's phone calls every week. During ICANN meetings, sometimes there are face-to-face meetings, and in addition to that, there's the possibility to exchange thoughts and positions on a mailing list. And sometimes people are requested to do some work in subgroups to deal with specific items and then go back to the whole working group and present the results, because sometimes it's difficult to deal with difficult tasks as a group. So sometimes it's good to split up to subgroups, which the according procedures allow for. And if this work is being done, and if according to the working group charter, which spells out the request, an initial solution has been crafted, if the working group thinks, okay, this is something that we could present to the wider audience, we're not yet completely sure whether this is the ultimate solution, but this is something that we think is good for presenting, then the working group, with the assistance of staff, produces the working group initial report. And that's being put out for public comment again to get input from everybody virtually. And this public comment is then analyzed, and the working group will then give everything a second thought and refine its recommendations if need be, and then a final report is being produced. And again, the initial report as well as the final report are also being discussed in the GNSO Council. So once we have the initial, the final report adopted, this goes to the GNSO Council. And usually, and we can try to fill this with some real-life examples, the questions that are being asked to the working group result in recommendations on how to deal with specific issues. So there are recommendations, and these recommendations are then being transformed into a draft motion that is being put before council, so that the council then is asked to resolve that the working group recommendations are being adopted. And if that happens, if after the council's deliberations, working group recommendations are being adopted, they are being presented to the ICANN board, which analyzes and looks at the recommendations, which again solicits for public comments, and then the board votes on these recommendations. And if they are adopted, if the GNSO recommendations are being adopted, then they go to the implementation phase, i.e. then contracts, documents, technical procedures are altered in a way to reflect the outcome of the PDP working group's work. And I should also say that sometimes it's not really easy to implement what has been recommended by a working group. Maybe an example that makes it easy for everybody to understand are the new GTLD recommendations that have been made by the GNSO way back when. And as you will know, the new GTLD program is working on the basis of the applicant guidebook that was sort of the that were spelled out the rules for applicants to apply. And that is a book worth of 350 pages. So if you add consensus policies and further documents to that, an applicant has to follow some 1,000 pages of paper. And certainly the recommendations that have been made by the GNSO at the time can't possibly reflect each and every detail that needs to be spelled out when operationalizing something. And there's often the question, what is policymaking and what is implementation? So we have vivid discussions at times when ICANN operationalizes GNSO recommendations, and sometimes it's being felt by certain community members that they are going too far there, that they're making their own policy. So it's very difficult to sometimes separate policy from implementation. And at this point, I'd like to highlight, and I think that this is sometimes forgotten, the work of the PDP does not end when the working group passes on its working results to the council. But actually, implementation oversight is something that's smithed into the whole PDP life cycle, and I think we're not making enough use of this implementation oversight to ensure that the spirit and the original thinking and the ideas, the wealth of knowledge that a working group has built over time when discussing for a year or so, that this actually goes into the implementation. So I think I'll leave it at that. I have to check. I think there has been a question in the chat, but I think that Marika has responded to that already. Okay, so I will then move on. So part of that we've already covered. So as I mentioned, at the start out of the working group's work, constituency and stakeholder group statements are asked for. So we we're also looking for opinions of ACs and SOs. Those are acronyms often used for advisory committees and supporting organizations very early in the process in order to ensure that we have everybody's thinking on our radar when conducting the work. You've heard about the initial report. You've heard about public comment, which is, in fact, influencing the outcome of the work. We spoke about the review that is conducted with the public comment review tool that ICANN staff is deploying for those purposes. And we've talked about the final report upon which the adoption, the recommendations are being sent on to the GNSO Council. So you find links on this slide. If you are interested in the details of how this is all governed, so that is the ICANN bylaws, it's the PDP manual, and the PDP overview. So I would recommend that if you think you're feeling too good, if your mood is too good, and you think that you should feel a little bit more moderate, then you can read that. It will certainly be a good sedative. Also, if there's a rainy day and you have nothing better to do, then you should go and read those documents. I'm not saying that they're not interesting and that they're not important, but that's legal language that pretty much encompasses the whole process, and these documents, at least as far as the GNSO part is concerned, are constantly being reviewed. There's actually a standing committee on improvements which constantly looks at flaws or needs for alterations of these documents in order to improve them, in order to make the process as transparent as possible. So if you can, go have a look at those documents and read them. That will certainly be very instructive. But apart from that, if you have questions, ICANN staff as well as your working group colleagues that are more experienced will be more than willing to assist you with this. Now, consensus policy and the picket fence. If you go and register a domain name, let's say a .com domain name, you have a couple of parties involved. That's the registry that does the work in the background that maintains the central database with all the registration data, or part of the registration data in some cases, but let's not go there. That would be, in this instance, a company called VeriSign. And what authorizes VeriSign to run .com? They have a contract with ICANN, which is the registry agreement that they've signed with ICANN. You might go to a registrar of your choice because ICANN prescribes that domain names cannot be bought or registered directly with the registry, so you have to go to a registrar. And all these registrars need to have an accreditation granted by ICANN. And so these two parties that you directly and indirectly are in contact with when doing a domain registration, they're called contracted parties. So they have contracts with ICANN. And there is an area in these contracts that is open to ICANN policy that's crafted by the ICANN community, i.e. that is crafted in GNSO PDPs. And why is that? Now imagine there is a contract between two parties, and parts of this contract have commercial impact. How much can the registry increase their prices for the next couple of years? That's something that is open to a commercial negotiation between contractors. And therefore, these items, these merely commercial items, are being discussed between the two parties, i.e. the registry or the registrar and ICANN. But then there are other areas which should be the same for everybody. So when it comes to transferring a domain name, all the registrars technically need to play by the same rules. So if we wanted to change the way domain names are being transferred, because there might be a specific need for that, we need to ensure that all parties offering generic names are actually playing by these rules, because otherwise, let's say one registrar had its contract only expiring in 7 years and you wanted to transfer your domain name to that registrar, I'm sure you wouldn't want to wait for 7 years until during the renewal of the contract that registrar is required to follow the new rules. So basically, a consensus policy is something that is binding for all contracted parties instantly. And in the contract, you always have this provision that the registries or registrars, as the case may be, have to follow consensus policies, both existing consensus policies as well as new consensus policies. So if now a consensus policy is adopted, then all the legacy TLD operators and as well as registrars have to follow that. And also all, talking about new DTLDs, for example, all new TLD operators have to follow that without the requirement of renegotiating their contracts. And I think that's a very, very nice concept that ensures that there is consistency throughout the whole community. I'm a big fan of that, and sometimes it's forgotten. You know, people sometimes claim that GNSO policy development is cumbersome, is taking far too long. But this is, as the word says, consensus policies. The community is trying to find out what is broadly accepted, what everybody can live with. And if we have standards that are broadly accepted and that are thoroughly contemplated by the community with input from the outside world, then you have acceptance and it will actually sustain that reduces the risk of participants wishing to game the system. That also increases transparency. So even though consensus policy making is a cumbersome process at times, I think it's the best we can have, and I think that what we have shows that we're doing quite a decent job with this. Now, I think I've covered pretty much of this, but I think it's good to remind ourselves of the main points, and this is why I think the quote from the agreement is quite helpful. That means that consensus policies are such policies that do not unreasonably restrain competition, and that the policies need to be related to one of the three issues spelled out in the middle of the slide, and that's issues for which uniform or coordinated resolution is reasonably necessary to facilitate interoperability, technical reliability, and or stable operation of the Internet or domain name system. You will remember my example of the transfer of domain name that just must work regardless of what operator you go to. Registry registrar policies reasonably necessary to implement consensus policies relating to registries registrars, and resolution of disputes regarding the registration of domain names as opposed to the use of such domain names. The dispute resolution part, that alludes to UDRP, the Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy. So regardless where you register a domain name and where the rights holder sits, this is an online process that can be used to resolve domain name disputes, trademark infringement cases, which are particularly defined in this policy. And the UDRP is now many years old. I think it's celebrating its 15th anniversary shortly. Marika will be able to help out, but I'm not inclined to put you on the spot. But that's one of the big success stories because it made lives much easier of rights holders not to have to do litigation at the global level. Now, picket fence, now you see a picture, now you know what the picket fence is, and I now see a question in the chat. What was UDRP again? That's the Uniform Dispute Resolution Procedure. And we now have two of those mechanisms. One is the UDRP, which is already existing and which is binding for all TLDs. The aim of that is for somebody whose rights are infringed upon to obtain a domain name. And then we have another mechanism, which is the URS, the Uniform Rapid Suspension System, that doesn't aim at getting a domain name, because in many cases the rights holders don't want a domain name that they have to pay registration fees for, but they're interested in just stopping certain scenarios of abuse, i.e. selling of fake goods, fake pharmaceutical products and stuff like that. And for that, the Uniform Rapid Suspension System is in place, which just helps to shut down domain names by sort of compromising the DNS. So the picket fence is this part that I tried to describe earlier in this presentation, where everybody needs to play by the same rules. That's what doesn't affect the commercial details of a contract, for example. So inside the picket fence, that's where the GNSO and its policy making can take place. Outside the picket fence, there's no such option. Certainly, the GNSO can make policy outside the picket fence. That would be non-PDP work. So we're sometimes asked as a council to provide policy advice on certain issues. So we can offer advice outside of PDP, and sometimes for this type of advice, even non-consensus policy PDP working groups are established. But the main purpose, I should say, of the PDP working group is for the outcome to result in consensus policies that have to be followed by everyone. At the link that you see on this slide, you find a more detailed presentation about consensus policies, and I think that's worthwhile reading. Working group guidelines. I think we've covered some of that, and I know that we're approaching the top of the hour rapidly. So I will make sure that nobody has to spend more time than for the next 9 minutes. But let's go through these points swiftly. The working group guidelines are basically there to optimize productivity and effectiveness. I think everybody will understand that it's difficult to work remotely. It's difficult to manage a sometimes very diverse group of working group members. You know, the working group chairs are not managers. You know, they're not moderators. They're not facilitators. They have their own day jobs and their expertise, which might not be being the shepherd to a herd of working group members with very diverse cultural and linguistic backgrounds. So, and also different expertises. So the working group guidelines shall help to frame this a bit. So they say something about the first meeting of a working group. What shall be done there? They say things that might be obvious to you, but I think it's an important thing, though, that they say we have to do an introductory round. So everybody should say who they are, who they're working for, what interests they are representing. And that is also, you know, it's not grouping, not only a team-building exercise, but it also helps the working group chair to see who has what expertise, whom could we ask best to deal with certain items and thereby maximize the outcome of the working group. So it also speaks about what members should do, the responsibilities. We spoke about the possibility to split into subgroups earlier. It's about participation and representativeness. We even have something on I think it's been called netiquette way back when, but there are rules on how you should behave when acting on working groups to keep the process integral. The methodology for decision-making, you know, it's not the working group chair just putting his finger into the wind and say, okay, I think we all agree that this or that is the case. But there is a methodology on how the will of the working group is actually being determined. And if people are not happy with the chair's determinations, then they can even appeal against that. It also says something about the tools that we're using and speaks to the product and the output of what a working group does. I mentioned earlier that that working groups that are working on consensus policies are working consensus-driven. So in an ideal case, everybody would agree and everybody would be happy with the outcome of working group work. And for that to happen, it is one exquisite and challenging task for the working group chair to determine the consensus level. So we don't vote in working groups. I think that's very important. We don't count noses. But the working group chair actually tries to test the water every now and then. It's an iterative process to see, well, do you like this? Who likes this? What do you not like with this specific proposal? Are there alternatives that we could work on? You know, to see how the group as a body thinks, and then based on that, the working group chair makes a determination whether there is full consensus inside the group, which means that everybody is in favor of recommendations, whether there is consensus or rough consensus, which means that there are only a few that are against specific recommendations. Then we have strong support but significant opposition, and that's where it's a little bit more than a majority if you would vote, but as we don't vote, it's less than rough consensus or consensus, but still substantial enough for a recommendation to be put before the GNSO Council. Then we have divergence, which means that we have different positions, but they're not, they can't be harmonized. So there's nothing. There are positions that are not strong enough, or that don't get enough support to be presented to the GNSO Council. And then we have minority views, which can go with all of the above, except for full consensus where everybody agrees. So if, let's say, there is a consensus situation where you, the position that you support is not recommended, then you can say, okay, I'm not in favor of this, and I would like to put in writing why I think this is not a good idea. And this minority view is published with the respective report, so everybody can take a look at it, and you might be able to influence the next round of decision-making with that. Again, some links for you to follow to get some supporting documentation. Tips and tricks. And I think we've almost reached the end of the slide deck. So you can go to gnso.icann.org. That's the main resource of information about the GNSO. You find the projects list there, which is referred to at the end of this slide. You find a full calendar with upcoming meetings, but you also find slide decks, MP3s, and transcripts of many meetings. So if you're interested in the history of decision-making, you can really go back and find out an awful lot about how things came into existence. Then we have the GNSO 101. 101 may not mean anything to you and your linguistic environment, and it didn't mean too much to me as well, but basically that's starting information. That's very basic material for you to acquaint yourself with the niceties of how the GNSO works. I think the acronym helper, which is now incorporated on the ICANN website as well to make it easier for everybody. Then we have a couple of wikis that you can navigate through that also have various documents in them that are constantly updated so that you have one place where you can see the status of various projects. We have this learning initiative that I recommend going to. And I think the best way for you always, rather than navigating websites, is talk to your colleagues. You know, I've met so many friends during my time at ICANN, and I've never seen anybody refusing to help out. So I think that you will find people helping you as well as I did. And rest assured that even those that are looking so very experienced don't know everything. So there's no such thing as stupid questions, and I think everybody will be forthcoming, providing the answers to the questions that you surely have. And also contact the excellent policy staff. I think that The team that Marika introduced earlier is just awesome. Their turnaround times are frighteningly short. They work 24 hours if you need them to, so they're excellent, and you can tap their expertise as well. And with that, I'd like to hand back over to our host, Marika. Thank you.
Thanks, Dominic. I think it was a great overview. I hope everyone agreed with that. And I don't see many hands going up yet, so I think everything was probably pretty clear. But I think now is the moment to raise any questions you may have, either about things that Thomas explained or spoke about, or maybe issues that he didn't cover or didn't address, but you're still interested to hear about. The dev has raised his hand. Please go ahead.
Thank you, David Antilaksing. I'm currently serving on the ELAC. So a question then, going back to the accessibility of the working groups. Okay, so the transcripts are available, but let's say if you review the transcripts, any questions, or you want to pose some questions or seek clarification from the working group, can an observer do so? Or is it siloed and closed off?
Yes, no, Marika, go ahead.
Go ahead. Thomas, go.
No, I think everybody will be wholeheartedly invite you to ask questions. I think each and every feedback is more than welcome.
Yeah, and this is Marika, to add to that, the way that sometimes happens is indeed that someone either sends an email to the chair of the working group asking for questions to be shared, or works with another representative in the working group that may come from the same community asking to forward or communicate those questions. So as Thomas said, any input or any feedback is always welcome to working groups. So either you do that to the full working group, or certain questions you may want to ask as well to individual members if it's more a question of getting clarification or further information on what the working group is looking at. But as Thomas explained as well, there are also, of course, formal steps in the process by which formal input is requested, either from stakeholder groups, constituencies, supporting organizations, and advisory committees at the start of the process, but also at the moment of an initial report, or a working group at any point may also decide to open a public comment forum or put forward questions that they may want to have input on. It may also be important to point out that most GNSO working groups tend to meet face-to-face during ICANN meetings as well, so that would also be a great opportunity for anyone that has questions or just wants to observe what's going on to attend those meetings. They're typically open to anyone interested. I think most working groups will structure the meeting in such a way where the first hour they may just do their usual business and continue their deliberations, but then open up the last half hour of such a meeting to answer questions or solicit input from observers that are attending that meeting. So I think there are different ways in which that can be done, and I think the more information, the better, is a typical motto of these working groups. Are there any other questions at this stage? I think, as Thomas already indicated, from the policy staff side, we're always available and willing to try and answer your questions. There are also a lot of experienced community members around, and I think Thomas has already given you a great example on the knowledge and experience that they have in-house. So feel free as well to reach out to GNSO community members if you have any specific questions on, for example, what it entails to participate in working groups. How much time should you be expected to spend? What are some of the topics that are under consideration? And a lot of information is said is also in the links that we've provided on the website. So this is a monthly recurring call. So should between now and then you have any further questions, you would like to come back once more and hear some further information about some of these items, you're, of course, more than welcome to join. Not seeing any further hands at this stage, and I'll pause here for a second. I think we'll probably just go ahead and close off the meeting. I don't know, Thomas, if there's anything further you would like to say or share.
No, I'd just like to thank you for the opportunity to do my bit in trying to encourage more people to join working groups. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for your questions to our participants. Been an enjoyable hour, and I hope to see you in face to face, probably in London or on some other occasion. Bye bye.
So thanks very much, everyone, for joining, and hopefully see you around very soon, either online or in person. Thank you very much.